Welcome to episode 113 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We also have a special guest today. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up at the night sky, and this episode and this podcast is for anybody else who likes going out under the stars and doing some deep sky observing. And today we have a special guest, longtime visual observer, good friend of mine, Bill Weir. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hi. Yeah, I'm supposed to talk now.
Yeah, we'll get you to talk now. So maybe what we'll do is just get you to do a brief introduction of yourself, maybe a little bit of your background and how you got started in amateur astronomy and how long have you been doing it, anything else you wish to share, and then we'll just have a conversation.
Yeah, so I don't really know how long I've been interested in astronomy. I grew up in a moderately small town in South Central British Columbia, and it was reasonably dark skies even from the city. And so I was always looking up at the sky, and then you grow up and then you haven't got time and you get busy with family and kids and work and stuff. But then I guess it was the late 90s, I told my wife, I think I'm going to buy a telescope. I had no idea what I was doing. Internet was small. I did some searching around and eventually ended up with a six inch Orion Dobsonian telescope, and had no idea what I was doing, didn't belong to any clubs. And I just started trying to find things in the sky without really knowing what I was doing. I found a small atlas, the Cambridge Sky Atlas, and I came up to this conclusion that wasn't based on any reality, that if it was in this little tiny atlas, I could probably see it with my telescope.
Yeah.
And actually, to be honest, that hasn't failed me with that telescope. And I did that for a few years, and then I stumbled upon the Messier list, and I decided, well, that will really help me hone my skills. I decided that if I could find all these objects on it, then I could probably find anything that I set my mind to. And I had Night Watch too, which was guiding me through things. And it's just sort of gone from there. I joined the RASC and obtained a few of their observing certificates and picked up a friend who was an observer, but also a telescope builder. And he at one point sold me his, what was an 11 inch telescope, then a Dobsonian truss that he built. And I bought a better mirror for it. Well, my wife bought me a better mirror for it, which was really nice. And then eventually, as I moved on and I was thinking, well, at some point when I retire, I'll buy a bigger telescope. And my wife said, you should get it now instead of waiting till you retire.
Yeah.
Because, you never know. We're both nurses and we've seen a lot of things, plans go sideways. And so I bought the big telescope. I bought a 20 inch Starmaster with a very fine Lockwood mirror, so it's very fast focal length, so I can keep my feet on the ground the whole time I'm observing with it. And every chance I get, I go out, whether it's with my little telescope or my big telescope. The 12 and a half inch never really comes out now because setting up the big one is just as easy. Yeah. And I live in a reasonably rural, dark place. My skies are as good as you can get without driving for a long ways.
Yeah.
Because on an island, on the south end of Vancouver Island where I live, the lights are all around us in Seattle to the south. And so you have to make do with what you have. But I have some pretty decent observing sites that I can go to. One that's a facility that belongs to a small international school, and I just push the limit with what I can do of visually observing from where I am.
I sort of first became aware of you when I was doing quite a bit of deep sky observing and then kind of searching out people that were kind of pushing those limits like you were talking about, and I ran across your name and a whole pile of your sketches online, and I was just like, man, this guy knows how to observe.
Yeah, but I've just been sort of making it up as I go along.
So, but I think you were working on the RASC challenge object list at that time. So, you know, I could see like, you know, some of your sketches of some pretty challenging objects. I think at that time you were using the 12 inch or whatever size it is.
Yeah, that's what I had at that time.
Yeah.
And then I had access to a 25 inch at the school. So for the really hard ones, then I would climb the ladder in the dome and risk my neck in the dark by myself.
Yeah, that's cool.
So Bill, what is the focal length of your 20 inch?
The focal length or the ratio?
Well, both, I guess.
It's an F3.3.
Wow. That's incredible.
I use a paracore, so it makes it about 3.7, which I think is about 1,900 millimeters focal length, something like that.
Yeah. Wow. You know, just about every 20 inch I've seen is, you know, the obsession, kind of the classic obsession style where you need a step ladder to get up to the eyepiece, and the views are stunning, but you know, it's an awful pain to be up and down a ladder, you know, in the darkness. So a 20 inch that you just, you're, like you said, your feet are planted on the ground. That's an incredible instrument.
Well, when it's really high up, I have to stand on my toes. So at the school, I used to keep this brick, like a cinder block that I would keep off to the side that I could just kind of kick into place that I could stand on when I really needed to. But for most things, if you wait an hour, it's moved past that point where you need to stand that tall. Yeah. Cool. And it has go-to and tracking. When I was spending the money, I thought I would spend all the money. I didn't really need the go-to. I wanted the tracking, but the tracking can't work without the go-to. So
yeah, that makes sense. We should mention this, that Bill's actually doing this from his backyard, and I think there's a bird there or something.
Yeah, there's birds out. There's a robin's nest. They're building it up under the eave on just outside of where I am.
Yeah, very cool. I want to ask you a little bit about the facility that you work at. I thought it was a 20 inch, but you're saying it's a 25. So my notes aren't correct here. But when I was out there, I guess it's about 6 or 7 years ago now, I was out with a whole pile of other people for what's called the RASC General Assembly. And so that's when all the amateur astronomers that belong to the RASC, if they're involved in committees and that, get together, and it was hosted by the Victoria Center. And I was really excited to go because I don't know that I'd met you. Maybe I met you one other time. I don't remember, but we were actually able to hang out and spend some time. And you were kind enough to actually drive me and a bunch of other people out to that facility to take a look. It's really an amazing spot. Can you tell us about the instruments there and where it's located? It's way up on this hill, I remember. And the view, I remember we got out there and I was on the U.S. Cell service when we got out there because you're right on the border. Can you tell us a little bit about that site and your involvement there?
Yeah, so in my community, there's a high school, like a IB high school college network called United World Colleges. And so one of them is here in my community. It's just down the road. It's 100, I think there's 160 students there now. They're from all over the world. About half of them are from Canada. It's a full scholarship kind of place. So kids apply from all over the world to come to it and get their, essentially what would be grade 11 and 12 in the IB program. And they live in dormitories, and probably about 25 years or so ago, a couple of the students there approached one of the instructors and said, you know, we'd like as one of our activities to do astronomy. And so he told them that he was the physics and math instructor. And he said, and had some interest. And so he said, okay, well, we can do that, but you have to buy a telescope. Mm-hmm. And so they raised some money and they bought a small, I think it was an 8-inch Celestron. And it started from there. And then eventually their instructor became friends with Jack Newton, the early astrophotographer guy. And he had a large telescope in his home. He had a 25-inch F5. Actually, at first it was just on a equatorial mount on a trailer that he dragged around, and he had some contacts with lots of people, and they raised a whole bunch of money and got some money from all sorts of sponsors and that. And they built an observatory on the top of the hill using a pier that had been part of a wind vane, a weather windmill kind of experiment that had eventually blown over in a large wind, but the pier was still there.
Okay.
And so they built a dome around it and dug trenches to get power up there. And now it's a dome and there's a roll top shed. And actually, and then when Jack Newton retired from his job and moved to the interior of British Columbia, he left behind his giant telescope. And the RSC has sort of been involved with that space ever since. And so in their dome, they have his old F5 25-inch Newtonian on a very large equatorial mount. In the shed, they recently actually acquired some inheritance donations. So they now have a 15-inch Obsession. They have a 140-millimeter TEC.
Oh, wow.
Refractor, a nice triplet. And so they have three piers in there. The instructor involved, he's fully automated everything. He rebuilt that big mount that you saw that the Newtonian was on. So now it's a go-to mount.
Okay.
And the other stuff they can all remote image. So the shed is set up as an imaging thing. And they can do that from inside the classroom in the main floor of the dome. And I've been volunteering there for probably about almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
When I learned that the RASC went out there and there were some members who had keys, and one of the people involved said, I said, so how do you get a key? I mean, it's just down the road from my house. And she just looked at me and said, you volunteer, in a very stern voice. And I thought, oh, that's easy. So I contacted the instructor and I went out there a few times, and suddenly at one of the meetings, a person was handing me a key from somebody who wasn't going out there anymore. Wow. And I've been going out there ever since. It's sort of been sad for the last year. I've been locked out. I can't go there because it's a closed campus now. So the kids are living in isolation. So they're a secure little bubble of their instructors and themselves. So I sneak out there on nights when I know they won't be up at the observatory, and I email the instructor and say I'm going out there, and he tells them, they send out a notice to the students, don't go up to the observatory, and then they do anyway. You know, kids will come because, well, you've been up there, Chris. It's a beautiful location.
It is.
It has a fantastic view. And kids who, like, there's young boys and young girls, and they wander up there in the dark to find just places to get away from being in a very tight little fishbowl. And so they come wandering by with their bright headlights on, and I pull my observing hood over my head, and they look at this guy in the dark, and sometimes they'll walk right up to me and say, so are you? And then I'll say, I'm not from here. And then they go away because they know that they'll get in trouble if they come in contact with people from the outside world.
Yeah.
And so it works out. And I'm just waiting. I got my first vaccination. So,
yeah.
And soon they'll be gone for the summer anyway. So,
yeah.
And I'll have free reign of the place.
Yeah. And that spot is fairly far removed from the regular campus. So I'm kind of almost surprised they come up there because it's a bit of a hike.
It is a hike, but they come up there regularly. They're young and they go hiking through the woods. The other night I was out there, and what are those like little one wheel kind of like boards that have like, it's like a Segway, but just a skateboard.
Yeah. I've seen them. Oh, yeah. I don't know what they are exactly.
Okay. It's in the middle of the night. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And suddenly I thought a car was driving up the road. And it's this kid on one of those with this bright headlight on. And he comes scooting past me and heads off down the hill in another direction. And then about 15 minutes later, he comes back up and by and back on down the road. It's like, okay, he was just out playing with his toy. And there's a little pond up there they come to. And so it's been a very fulfilling thing, though.
Yeah.
Working with the kids there and getting to meet kids from all over the world. And it's kind of how I got involved with one of the committees with the RAC about inclusivity and diversity.
Yeah.
And it was more about attracting people that aren't just white old men. into the society.
Yeah.
Because it's often the non-white kids that are at the school who are actually interested in the astronomy.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. Yeah. And it's great to hear. I know that like Stella was talking about the inclusivity and diversity branch of her organization, the AABSO. And then one of the people working on that, I don't know if she's on the one for the RAC, is Heather Laird. Remember Heather?
Oh, I know Heather. Yeah.
Yeah. And when we were there, that's where I met Heather, and you were actually carting us around. You took us down to downtown Victoria and toured us all around. That's how I ended up getting to know Heather a bit.
Very cool. She's a good person.
Yeah. So it's kind of neat. I have to ask though, and now I'm really curious because it is, it's 25 inch that's there. So what are some of the most memorable observations you've had through that? That's a large instrument. So what are some of the things that really stick out in your mind that you've observed through Jack Newton's old 25 inch?
Well, probably about 16 galaxies in the Corona Borealis galaxy cluster.
Okay.
That was it, 2065 AG. Yeah. The Abel Galaxy Cluster, the jet in M87.
You've seen that?
Wow. Yes. It's just like a little tiny nose sticking off of it. I like to observe by not, if at all possible, not looking at images to see if I can see the thing, what my impression will be. And then I'll look at images and descriptions later. Sometimes you have to, like when I've looked at like extragalactic globular clusters, you really need to know which teeny tiny dot on the page will be the globular cluster. But for the jet, it was like, I didn't want to know anything. I just kept applying power and it took, I don't know, 600 and some times. And the fact that it was, it lives outside, so it's pretty stable environment, the mirror and all that. And the fact that it was tracking so that I didn't have to like figure on that. And so that was fun. And then it's like, there's three stars in the field of view. And so it was pretty easy to match those up with when I did find an image that would show where it was. And things like the double quasar in, is it in Ursa Major?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's an object that I've always wanted to observe is the double quasar, because that's one of the, like for listeners that aren't familiar with the double quasar, I believe that that's one of the most distant objects that amateur telescopes can observe, you know, with the right aperture and that kind of stuff. Like, isn't it like 8 billion light years away?
I think it's even more than that now.
Okay.
That they figured even more. Yeah, wow. But it is. It's like that. And with the 25 inch, it would actually split. So you could actually see with my 20 inch, I've seen it like a peanut.
Yeah.
But with the 25 inch, you could just, it was like splitting this super tight double. So that was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely a bucket list item for me. I would love to see that one day, especially through a 25 inch. That would be something else.
That would be deadly.
You have to climb a tall ladder on that one. That one was like, I was really risking being found. Because the scope is pointed almost straight up.
Yeah.
So I couldn't get, and it's a tall ladder. It's like about a 3-meter ladder.
Yeah.
And I had it jammed as tight as I could against the pier. And I still had to put one foot over sort of on top of the head of the equatorial mount. So to peer in the eyepiece.
Oh.
Yeah, because I'd learned about it. And so suddenly it's like, I have to go see that. And so it was like, I left the computer and drove out to the observatory. It like stuck in my mind like instantly the minute I read about it online, and it was like, I have to go see that now. And that was kind of, I did that once with it was like a really long time ago when I first gotten sort of access to the place. What's his name? It was a new nebula that was discovered in Orion. McNeil's Nebula, I think it was.
Yeah, yeah, it's near M78.
Near M78, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, the night that that was discovered and was launched on the internet, I drove out to the observatory and found it.
Wow. Because, well, that's a variable nebula. I don't think it's always visible. Anyway.
I know, and that's what, that was the point of it. So it's like, I didn't know how variable meant. I didn't think. I thought maybe it'll go away by tomorrow, so I have to go now.
Like, seize the opportunity.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's the advantage of it being like 5 minutes away. Oh, and that's something else I saw. With that scope, and I know, I'm pretty sure I'm the only person. Remember when they launched that brass ball into the comet and made it brighten?
Yeah.
I saw that with that telescope.
Wow. That sounds like an incredible instrument.
And it was only, it was only because we're on the West Coast and far enough south, because it wasn't supposed to be visible from Canada. But for about a week and a half, I'd been tracking the comet using whichever scope was in my hands. And so I knew its path. And I went out there that night to see it, to with the timing and all that, because it was just, you know, need the ball to hit and then wait for about 20 minutes for it to show up. And it was cloudy, but I thought I have to be there just in case. And, you know, the time had passed and it was a little bit late, but I still had the scope. I was, you know, I knew where it was and I had seen it earlier, and then it clouded up, and it like earlier in the evening, and then it clouded up. And then as I was driving home, in my rearview mirror, I could see in the distance, it was clear in that area of the sky. So I turned around and drove back up there. And now things were so low in the sky. All I really had to do, because the slit was always set to the west, all I had to really do was open the slit about 5 feet and drop the door on it and wiggle the scope a little bit. And there it was. And it had like a brighter core. And so it was that was a fun one, because that was
Comet Temple 1, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was back when they, you know, were trying, they actually launched the ball, and then the comet, I believe, actually flew into it in the way that it worked.
Yeah. But, I think NASA called that the Deep Impact mission or something.
Yeah, Deep Impact. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So that was fun. Like, that wasn't. Yeah, I thought, I'm the only person in Canada. I said that to somebody. He said, yeah, well, I saw it on my like 56 inch screen. And I said, no, you didn't.
Yeah. So it's so different seeing something in the eyepiece versus.
Well, it was the concept of it and the chase. Yeah. I love those chases where if you don't go, you just won't see it. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to, even if it looks crappy, like,
you know, yep.
I've sketched Mars in the rain.
Yeah.
Well, I was at the observatory, and I went out there for the night of closest approach, because I'd been doing a series of panels of the different sides of Mars, and it was raining, but I went out there anyway, because I had the view and I knew where it was. And then it cleared up where Mars was, but it was raining where I was. So I dragged their 10-inch Dobsonian into the doorway of the outer cold room. So I was under the eave and sat on a chair and pointed it at Mars and did my sketch.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Bill, have you done any planetary observing with that 25-inch?
Not very much. With my 20 inch, yeah. I had the most amazing view of Mars this summer when it was right around closest, and we had some excellent seeing. And I had my 6-inch out one night in the driveway, and it was so beautiful. And so the next night it was going to be the same sort of sky, and I put my 20 inch on it, and I have never seen that much. I found an image from Damien Peach done at the same time. And it's like, yeah, all those little tiny feathery lines, they were all the same.
Yep. We end up getting that sky. It eventually drifted over us, and I was able to use about 350 power on my 4-inch refractor.
Yes, it was like beautiful seeing. It was just amazing. Yeah. And it was right around pretty much closest approach. It was
Have you looked at like Uranus or Neptune with it?
Not really. No, I have with my 12 and a half inch to look for the what's Triton and Oberion.
Yeah.
Yeah. But not too much. They're so low down right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. What about like, what does the Orion Nebula look like through the 25 inch? You must've looked at that a few times, I imagine.
Oh, it's stunning. But the field of view is so small. It's always, I always use my 20 inch because I can get much better field of view. You know, if I put a 20 millimeter, 100 degree eyepiece in, I can get almost a degree of sky. So
what are you, what are you using for eyepieces in that?
I have a 20 inch Explore Scientific 100 degree. My three main eyepieces are that, which is my finder eyepiece, because I don't even have a finder scope on this, the scope. I just use the eyepiece. I have a Telrad. Wow. I have a Telrad and an eyepiece. Okay. And then I have a 10 millimeter Ethos that I bought from Alvin Huey. Yep. And a 6 millimeter Ethos. Those are my three main eyepieces that I use with it.
Nice.
And I finally pried out of a friend's hands that he doesn't use anymore, a 31 Nagler, which gives a little bit wider field of view.
Yeah.
I mean, it has a crazy exit pupil. It's probably about a 9 millimeter exit pupil. So there is wasted light.
Yeah.
But, you know, that field of view, it's fabulous. I used that this summer for when I was viewing Comet Neowise. I had my 20 inch out quite a few nights observing that because you could see right down to the core. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I remember your sketches. They were beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. Do you observe nebula much or mostly just like galaxies and comets and that sort of thing?
Everything. I look at everything. I'm not selective.
Yeah.
I really like finding things. And so if I find out something can be found, then I like to go find it. It's like, it's always been something I've done since childhood is look for things. And it's, you know, my other hobby is mushrooming. So that's looking for things. And, so it's just, I'll look at anything. I'm not super selective on, if it's something that could be a challenge, then I'll go for it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. For me too, like one of the joys of astronomy with like, you know, a manual alt as mount is finding the object. It's a little bit of a treasure hunt is what I usually try to explain it as to folks that, you know, ask me why what I enjoy about astronomy and why I do it manually. And there's a great sense of pleasure, you know, when you track something down, especially a challenging object, whether it's a tight double or a faint planetary nebula or something like that. When you actually find it and observe it, you know, I just feel good. It's one of the parts of the hobby that, you know, when I started, it was all about looking at things. And, you know, now that I'm into it, that's still, you know, obviously the main carrot, but I do enjoy just the, you know, star hopping and moving through the sky to try to find whatever I'm looking for.
Yeah. That's like a couple of years ago, we went on a trip to Bhutan, my wife and I, with a group. And it was actually based around mushrooming. And when we met one of the people on it, she was young and she had no interest in this at all. And then when we were in one area and we were looking for a specific mushroom and she found one. Well, she didn't even know she found it. She said, look at this weird mushroom I found. She showed us a picture and we're like, well, that's what we're looking for. You know, like, where did you find that? And then she was thrilled because, first of all, her husband on that whole day never found one. But once she learned it, it was like, I said, see, and I knew what she was into. She was into Pokemon Go. And she was playing the game the whole time we were there in Bhutan because there were like rare Bhutanese Pokemons or something like that. And then I explained to her, see, it's like Pokemon Go. And so that's kind of like what astronomy is too, right? They got to catch them all.
Yeah, I love that. That's awesome.
That's,
you know, cool. That's kind of like when I was working through lists, and I had worked through a few lists, and like Chris said, the Deep Sky Challenge, and I've done the finest NGCs and the Messiers, and then I thought, what could be the next one? And then I thought, well, I should just go for the list, which was to me the first list, which was Herschel 2500.
Yeah.
And so that was like a 10-year project, right? Because it was battling the spring weather, the lightning sky, and so many galaxies that he found in the spring sky. And so that's why that one took 10 years.
What telescope were you using for that one?
All of them.
Yeah.
So when I decided to do it, it was this daunting list, and I was making up where to look for it in Uranometria, like compiling the list, marking pages, and so that I could pick a night and work a page so that I could always, whatever the weather, if there was only clear patches here or there, I could still work an area. I thought, this is so huge. And so I decided if I could go back, I looked through a year's worth of logbooks, and that if I could find a credible observation that had enough parameter tick boxes for this, well, I always put on my page what the sky conditions and all that are and what the scope is, but it was, you know, if I could really describe the object from my observation and not just say, yeah, saw it, then I could call that an observation. So I was able to add probably about 150 just in a day, because I went back. And so that had observations from my 6-inch telescope and my 12.5-inch. And I didn't even have my 20-inch at the time when I started that.
Yeah.
And so then it was mostly with my 12.5-inch and sometimes with the 25. And so, you know, that, and then once I had my 20-inch, then I just did it all with the rest of that. But again, it was not looking up previous observations. I would just go looking for it and see if I could see it. And then I would look afterwards at images and descriptions and see if what I had seen matched. And just out of the curiosity of see if I was seeing the same amount that somebody was with better sky conditions or whatever. And it quite surprises me with people. Yes, you can see almost as much from much inferior skies. That's what I was surprised at. But, you know, people just need to go try and then hone their skill. And that's just time.
So did you sketch all those?
No, because a lot of them would just be like the tiniest little faint smudge. I could have. I would just take a smudge pencil, and whether I did make a dot or a little line with a slightly brighter dot in the center, and then maybe take out a pencil and put a pencil mark in it, because a lot of them were like that.
Yeah.
Going through Virgo and Coma Berenice and all that, that's just like so many of them are so tiny and so faint.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Bill, have you ever tried? Some of them were
surprises.
Yeah. What was most surprising?
Well, it's just that, you know, you just, because I had never looked any of them up, all of a sudden it would be like, whoa, that's an, like, and it would just be not on anybody's list anywhere as like a great object to look at or something. And that would, you know, like, I always marked those with exclamation points. And so there was always like one or two that was just, you know, every night there'd be one or two that would be this like, whoa, why is that not one that people are talking about? Because it just looks so cool, really long and thin, or, you know, structure to it. You know, you see spirals or you see knots and things like that. So it was, yeah, I don't know. There was too many to remember.
Cool.
Yeah. Bill, have you tried observing the globulars in Andromeda?
A few of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one project when I went to the Merit Star Quest, which is in a pretty dark site in central British Columbia. I went there 1 year. Went down to -5 one night. I'm sleeping in the back of my pickup truck. That was cold.
Yeah, that's chilly.
And that was where I was happy that I had the tracking on my scope, because I decided to tracked down a whole bunch of the extraglobulars in other galaxies other than the Andromeda galaxy. So a couple of the ones in M33 and trying to think of which galaxies there are. There are satellite galaxies for M31. So a 185, 127 or something like that. They have some extraglobulars. And so I was able to find one in each of those. And there's a dwarf galaxy, one of our dwarf galaxies, WLMW or WLM or something like that. There's a globular in that. So it was, that was fun seeing, but they're, again, they're just like little dots. That's where you need to have actually the image to know what you're looking for. Because it's in a field of other stars and it might be in a clump. And so it's like, can I see all three? And then which one of the three dots? Because two of them are stars and one's a globular. But the main globular in M31, the Andromeda galaxy, I've seen that down to with just my 6-inch, the G1.
Really? Wow.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah, Shane hunted that down 1 year and showed me.
You see it as Mickey Mouse in the 6-inch. You can't split them apart, but it just looked like a Mickey Mouse.
Huh. Very interesting.
Yeah. I think you could go even smaller aperture on that and see it as a funny little fuzzy bit again. Like your refractor could do it, Chris. I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that. Shane did hunt it down one night. Yeah.
It took 240 times with the 6-inch to show it as Mickey Mouse.
Okay. Yeah. So you need a pretty good night, even if it was dark. Good seeing that too, probably.
We get good seeing here on the West Coast.
Yeah.
I can get little diffraction rings on my 6-inch scope all the time. Nice. I collimate it every time I take it out, even though it's a dog in a tube. I still play with the collimation every night. And then, the other night, a few nights ago, and the seeing wasn't great, I could get sharply 2 out of 3 of the craterlets in Play-Doh.
Wow.
And the CD one showed as like an elongation.
Yeah. Very cool.
And that's it. But when I'm looking at the moon with my 6-inch, I use orthos.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that those provide a better view, or why orthos, I guess?
Well, they're less glass. It's a smaller field of view. So there's a lot less distraction to it. But I always just use them now. I have a 5, a 6, a 7, and a 9, and those are what come out. And usually it's the 6 and the 5 that I play around with depending on the scene. And I like the color. It makes it gray and white.
Yeah. I've probably in the last 12 months or so, I've really been enjoying like the simpler eyepieces, and just especially like, for planetary and lunar observing. Just the crispness and like you said, the neutral color, really pops, and quite enjoy the views.
And when I was doing those globulars, those extra galactic globulars with my 20-inch, I was using orthos and a Barlow. Well, PowerMate, a 2.5-time PowerMate. So it was like crazy magnifications, 600 times and things like that.
Wow. Yeah, those power mates are great. I sell a lot of gear, buy stuff and sell stuff because I like messing around. And I used to have a 2.5 times power mate that I really regret selling. I should probably pick one up again because they're a handy little tool to have in the kit. When you want some extra power, like they really are, in my opinion, invisible in the light path. Like they really don't distort or add any, aberrations. It's a really well done piece of gear.
Mm-hmm. So what are you working on these days, Bill? Do you have a project currently that you're working through, or are you just doing more like general observing or revisiting favorites, or what's your current observing?
When I finished the Herschel project, which was kind of anticlimactic because I didn't even really notice at the moment that I finished it. Because it'd just been so long of just doing it that all of a sudden I realized, wait, that was the last one. And then I, for a couple of years, then I just looked at eye candy, you know, for the last couple of years. And then recently I decided I needed to create some more focus again. And long ago I'd started on the Herschel objects and was going with that. And it had kind of drifted away because I was down to where it was everything that was low down, you know, under Orion, running along the river there.
Yeah.
And so that's hard from here because I have to go out to the observatory for that because there's a beautiful view to the south.
Yeah.
But Port Angeles at the north end of the Olympic Peninsula is there, and their light pollution keeps getting worse. And so I have started picking it up again. But I still now have to wait until that sky comes around because I've sort of finished everything that's there. I have about 15 to go.
Okay.
And that was one that I had to use the 25 inch for, was the toughest one in the Hixson objects, which is Hixson 50, which is a little tiny, tiny ring of five galaxies up near M87, up almost right beside the Owl Nebula. And so that's what I'm working on now. But again, it's, you know, the summer. So I, you know, got to wait till almost midnight before it gets dark now.
Yeah. Cause you're at what? You're at about, you're a little bit further south than us.
We're 48 and a,
yeah, I was going to say
3.
Yeah. You get below 49 there. You're lucky.
Yes. We're 48.3, I think.
Yeah. So when we observe, we go down to 49.07.
Yeah. Right at the border.
Right at the border, yeah. Yeah, when we scare away the deer, sometimes you can actually see they'll go down and hop over the fence. That marks the DMZ.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, so it'd be great if you could come out and bring your 20-inch and do some observing of this down in the grassland sometime. That'd be awesome.
It's just so far.
It is far.
Yeah, that's a long way.
I can't go anywhere. I can't get off my island now.
That's right. Yeah, I heard. Yeah, you're.
If I tried to board the ferry with my trailer, then they would say turn around.
Yeah, they're not letting anybody across there. I work with somebody who's in Vancouver, and their son is going to school over at UVic, and they had to go and get them before they shut it all down. So we were doing a conference call the other day and they were on the ferry because they had to like rush over there and get them before it was too late, so to speak.
Yeah, because we keep wishing people would stay off our island.
Yeah.
It's all people from Alberta. It is. They come here to golf in the winter.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's been a wild time. So are you fully retired now?
Yeah, I've been retired for 3 years now.
Yeah.
Which is nice because then I can go whenever the weather is right.
Yeah.
And don't have to time it with getting up at 5:30 in the morning to go to work.
Wow.
So that's nice. Yeah. And then I don't have to worry if I sleep in.
Yeah. And that, I imagine that work you were doing was pretty stressful too. Cause you were actually in the emergency room though, I think, weren't you?
No, I worked in a weird little area called pre-admission, which is getting things ready for people to come for surgery and the patients and their charts and everything. So it was an office job. It was a teaching job. I taught patients about how to be ready for their surgery and what to expect afterwards. And did the pre-screening of their booking for surgery to decide if they were safe to do surgery on or if they needed to come see somebody and tests and things like that. So it was a fun job.
Yeah.
But it was starting to get weirder over time.
Yeah.
As people keep adding more things that they thought were necessary to do.
Yeah.
And fighting with doctors.
Yeah, that's never fun. Yeah. Yeah, very cool. So now you have, you're probably getting a lot more observing in, do you find, since retirement?
Probably. It's probably more that I can spend longer and I can do it on the nights. Like when I was younger, it didn't really matter. Yeah. I would go any night of the week. But, you know, then it was like getting up at 5:30 to go to work, you need a few hours of sleep.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I can at least go out when it's the right conditions now.
Yeah.
And not have to worry about it.
Yeah.
I was wondering, or when my wife just wants me to leave the house. Are you going out observing tonight? Have you looked outside? It's raining. No, I'm not.
Bill, you mentioned you have a Coronado PST, a solar hydrogen alpha telescope. Is that the only one you have for observing the sun?
I have a white light filter for my daub that I bought years and years and years ago. And you know, it was back when like buying a 6-inch solar filter cost like $200 or something like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I had it, and there was lots of solar activity. And then one day there was a partial solar eclipse, and you could just sort of see it from our property. I didn't have to leave. And I had it out in a corner of the yard, and it was because the sun was heading towards the trees, and I called my wife out to look at it. So like about 45% of the moon sun was gone, and showed her that. And then she was like, "Oh, well, that's worth $200. Yeah. So that was nice. It was verification.
And yeah. So, yeah.
It made it so I didn't worry when I decided that we were going to drive halfway across the United States to go see the solar eclipse, which was perfect for that. And I have a little 4-inch one that I've put a little foam ring on and rubber ring on so that I can stick it on. I have a little tiny ED80, a really early William Optics Zenith star.
Okay. Like there,
it's a purple tube one. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a great refractor or anything like that, but it's traveled with me. I bought it because it was really light and we were going to Costa Rica, and it's traveled with me quite a bit when I do things like that. And it's great for wide fields, and took it with us when we went to Wyoming for the solar eclipse. And I had that and my little PST set up on the beach in eastern Wyoming, showing people running around in the sun in bikinis and bathing suits and stuff like that. That was a fabulous trip. I'd recommend that campsite to anyone.
Oh yeah, where was that?
Except the Colorado people said we couldn't tell anybody about it.
Oh, it's a secret.
It's right beside Glendoe, Wyoming, which is almost in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And there's a lake there that was made by a damming the river, and there's state campsites all the way around it. And I had found online, because it would be right directly on the path, like the path went right through the middle of the campground. And so I decided that we were going to go there, and couldn't get a campsite because they sold out their campsites that were bookable like 2 minutes after they'd opened up the booking half a year before the campsite, before the eclipse, or about a year before. And so I just decided that if we leave here, because it took 3 solid days of driving to get there, if we leave here a week beforehand and get there, we will get one of the available spots. My wife didn't know that there were very few spots, which was great because she thought there were hundreds. So she didn't know the risk factor to it, right? And she kept saying, "So what's the plan?" And I said, "Well, on Monday, we get on the ferry and then we drive like hell." And so she said, "Well, maybe we should leave on Sunday." I said, "Okay." And so we caught a late ferry to Washington State, and we were able to get like as far as Spokane before it was late at night. And and we're dragging this little tiny motorcycle tent trailer that I have. And we got to the campground really late at night, drove this horrible, like, I don't know, it was probably about a 15-mile road winding in every single direction in the middle of nowhere. And the gas tank, I didn't know how much. And so it's like, I don't feel comfortable driving where we don't even know where we're going now. And so we went back and we found gas, and then we were fine. And we drove and found the campsite. And when we woke up in the morning, it was like being in the tropics. because this, because the Google Earth image did not look great, because I realize now when I looked at it, it was taken in the spring before there were leaves on the trees and the water was really high. It looked like desert wasteland. But we were in the middle of, like, you know, 30 meter cottonwood trees, perfect sand beach, because the campground actually is where there were sand dunes, because before there was a lake, it was just sand dunes. Wow. And the probably, you know, who knows, bottomless sand. And so when they made the lake, there isn't a rock to be seen in the sand. And so it was a beautiful place. We spent a week there. And then as, you know, as the days approached, they got fuller and fuller until it was just packed. And it was just the perfect place to, you know, spend the day watching, and then just emptied. As soon as the eclipse was over, it was like boom, and the worst traffic jam in the world happened heading south towards Colorado.
So
it's Glendo Lake Park. And if you want the best campground was the Sandy Beach campground. That was nice. Unbelievable. It was like $15 a night.
Wow.
Well, that's awesome.
How many nights did you spend there?
I don't know, 6 or 7.
Wow.
Yeah. Cost us nothing.
Dark
skies? There were houses renting for like $1,000 a night around that area. People were moving in, whole families were moving all together in houses and then renting out their houses for the people flying in for the day.
Wow.
The town was a party. The town has 300 people. There were tens of thousands of people there around the eclipse, but not where we were. It was all in the city. We went over to the city to see what it looked like, well, the town, and where they had the public space set up and where most of the camping was going on. They just converted this field. It looked like a refugee camp. It just looked like a refugee camp. I don't know how much money they were paying to just have like a postage stamp. So, I mean, probably being with that huge crowd at the moment would have been fabulous. Like the energy of it all, like being at the best concert.
Yeah.
But it felt like that at ours too. It had this wonderful, fun feel to it. Yeah.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. My wife and I drove down. We stayed in Sheridan, and then we drove down to Casper for the actual eclipse day. And they have like an event center with a huge parking lot. And that's where we went to observe it. And it was, like you said, just the energy of the people was something I never anticipated for the eclipse. But it was really neat just to hear like the people's reaction when it went to totality, and the minutes leading up to that. It was an energy that, you know, it's hard to put words to it, but it was really, really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Good. I was sick that week in bed. That's the only time I've ever been sick in the summer my whole life, I think.
Yes. It was fun just doing the trip, you know, because I know people that went to Oregon for it. And I know, and you took a risk being off the path and then driving into it.
Yeah.
Because I saw a picture of one friend and they observed it from the side of the road because where they were staying was off path. And then they decided they would drive into it. And there was such a traffic jam of all the people deciding to do that, heading north, south in Oregon, that they just pulled over at the side of the road and watched it. And that, I thought, oh God, I'm so glad that wasn't me. We were about 150 meters from the actual true center of the path.
Oh, that's incredible.
We would have had to be in a swamp to have been, like, there was a swampy area that was the actual dead center of the path. So we were as close as you could get. That was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We were a little concerned about the traffic. Part of it was we're fortunate we were north because a lot of the traffic was coming up from, you know, the southern states, it seemed, but we also left super early in the day. So we were there, I think it was 5 or 6 hours in advance of totality.
Right.
And we just relaxed and took out our chairs and read until it happened.
Good plan. Because this friend, it was his spouse that decided she didn't want to leave too early. It would have been, okay, you can stay here and watch the partial. And I'll leave you a pair of glasses.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, no, those chases are fun.
Yeah, they are.
Very cool. Well, I think we're getting to about time here. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to add, Bill, or anything you want to ask Shane.
No,
it's been great. Yeah. Thanks, Bill. It's odd, like, so Chris and I are primarily refractor observers, and, you know, so a big aperture to us is, you know, 4 to 5 inches. So I love living vicariously through people that observe with telescopes like what you have.
Your scopes are smaller than my secondary.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a big difference. My secondary is 4.5 inches.
That puts it into context, doesn't it?
Yeah, very cool. Man, I would love to look through that telescope someday, though.
It needs recoding, but I'm going to send it down to Zambudo to get it, but I'm going to drive it down because he's just south of Seattle.
Okay.
So I'm just waiting till hell is over. I was going to do it about a year and a half ago, and then everything got weird.
Yeah. So yeah,
unfortunately. Stuck on this side of the border.
Yeah, good stuff. All right.
I mean, I could drive down.
Good. Well, thanks so much for joining us again. We'll stop the recording and then we'll keep chatting for a few more minutes.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you everyone for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.